cheating heart will tell on you.
This is Marion Ross.
And Paul Michael.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI.
Kansas City Community Radio.
Support for KKFI provided by the 40th Annual Ethnic Enrichment Festival, Friday through Sunday, August 16th, 17th, and 18th in Swope Park, featuring food, music, dance, and crafts from more than 65 countries, as well as cultural information and hands-on activities for the kids. That's the 40th Annual Ethnic Enrichment Festival, Friday through Sunday, August 16th, 17th, and 18th in Swope Park. For details and the entertainment schedule, eeckc.org. That's eeckc.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are alone. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you opened and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. Like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. On top of that, your partner has parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded on.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us this week as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. Interesting show for you here today. I think you'll want to stick with us for the whole hour with all that's going on here. We're going to first talk with our friends over at the Kansas City Actors Theater, where they are doing a show that first premiered 140 years ago. It was considered very scandalous in its time. We'll hear why from the performers that are here today. Todd Lanker is with us. He plays the role of Torvald Helmer, and Hillary Clemens, who plays the role of Nora Helmer, in the Kansas City Actors Theater production of A Doll's House. It's actually the first of two productions, one by them, one by the Unicorn. We'll talk about that for a few minutes later on in the interview, but welcome to the show. Thanks, Michael. Hi. Yeah, it's set in Norway, but of course the play is in English. We don't want to confuse you that much. But the characters would not be speaking Norwegian if they were speaking their
tongue. Oh, no, they would be speaking Norwegian.
They would?
Yes.
Or would they be speaking Russian?
Well, I'm not. I would say Norwegian. Mm-hmm. I would say Norwegian, but the play is in translation, so we'll be speaking English, I promise.
Horvald was a businessman.
Yes.
What kind of business was Horvald in?
Well, one of the sort of inciting incidents of the play is that he's gotten a promotion at his job at the bank, the Joint Stock Bank, and he's to be the new president and director of the Joint Stock Bank, We hear bits and pieces that he's been in public service and has sort of left it because there wasn't room for promotion, but holds himself to a very high standard of ethics and professional behavior, and that has resulted in a very happy moment for the Helmers that he is going to be the new director of the Joint Stock Bank.
Has a lot of pride in that, I imagine. And he's probably a very well-thought-of man, good reputation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And very important to him that he be well-thought-of and that he continue to maintain a strong reputation as a sterling figure in the community.
So we're in 1879, something mm-hmm. like that.
That's right.
Yeah, and so he has a reputation to uphold. But then on the other side, he has this wife with different aspirations. Hillary, tell us about that.
Well, I don't know. I think at the beginning she has exactly the same aspirations as Torvald, and I think that's kind of the point. She is pretty proud of him. And I think extremely relieved that he's gotten this big new promotion that comes with also a big new salary, which is very important, not only because they'll be able to live in a higher style than they've been living, but also, unbeknownst to Torvald, they are in a less stable financial situation than he thinks they are in. Mm. Nora has a couple of secrets that she has been keeping.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this the cause of the scandal?
It leads to it.
It starts.
Snowballing. You know, we're in Norway, so everything's about snow. Sorry to our Norwegian listeners. But yes, everything
snowballs.
Well,
the show does begin on Christmas Eve.
You know. It's holiday.
What is the beginning of the problem? Were you an early feminist in your mind, do I think?
Well, you know, there's a lot of conversation around this play about whether it is a feminist play or not.
That's the impression I had.
Well, yes. I mean, and I would say, I mean, if you're going with the definition of feminism as the radical notion that women are people, then this is definitely a feminist play. I think that's very much at the heart of the play, which is that a woman who has only thought of herself and been told that she is a wife and a mother, starting to wonder if maybe she's also a person, and maybe first and foremost a person, and what that might mean in the context of her marriage and her house and her motherhood.
Well, what does she do that causes these problems?
Well, she starts out the play with, as I said, a bit of a secret. She has, unbeknownst to Torvald, saved his life by borrowing some money, which women at the time were not allowed to do without the consent of their husband or someone else backing that loan. And she did it without telling Torvald. He was very ill, and the doctors prescribed a trip abroad, somewhere south, warm in Italy. And he is very much against borrowing and being in debt, so she did it behind his back.
And from a very unsavory character.
Exactly.
I see.
Well.
And funnily enough, they get a little visitor on Christmas Eve, and it happens to be the man from whom she borrowed the money, and he has some questions for her about the validity of that loan and whether or not she might have engaged in some other illegal activity in order to procure that loan. So without giving too much away.
Oh, things are much clearer now as to why there's difficulty. But in some ways, Todd, you're kind of ignorant of
very. We've sort of joked around that the play is basically just people trying to keep things from Torvald. that everybody has all these secret relationships with Nora and all these, you know, wonderful, rich things going on below the surface that Torvald just knows nothing about as far as he's concerned. They have a very happy marriage. They're They are successful. They are the picture of the perfect couple. And also, I think we have these hints that he does sort of think of himself a little bit as a progressive. We have these little moments of him saying things like, we'll share this as husband and wife, which at the time particularly would be a very progressive notion. But the proof, as they say, is in the pudding. When it comes to all of that and how he really feels about each of their roles in the relationship and in the marriage.
What did men in that time, place, and circumstances, what were they like? Today, would we consider them maybe overbearing, something like that?
I think we probably would, yeah. Definitely, we would. I think, look at their behavior and kind of consider them, yeah, they're often, and Torvald is often played as very sort of caricatured in being overbearing and controlling. But I think it was the next step of the old maxim of children should be not seen nor heard. I think as far as husbands of the time were concerned, wives should be neither seen nor heard either, that this was a figure in the household whose job it was to support the husband, to keep a tidy house, to take care of and raise and teach the children.
And look nice
and not be really invested in the relationship other than as a grateful recipient of masculine
protection
and affections. Yeah. Yes.
Well, looking at the situation, having heard the explanations, I suppose I think of your character more as a hero in this circumstance. But would society in 1879 have thought of her as such?
Oh, well, in 1879, people were horrified and I think thrilled at the same time. By the way that this play ends, there were attempts to change the ending in subsequent productions, and, you know, several, I think, wives that were forbidden from seeing it in case they got any ideas. I read a review of a previous production where someone overheard someone in the audience say, oh, this is the play that broke up my parents' marriage. You know, we like to... you know, we like to talk a lot about, you know, what it was like then and the overbearing husbands and the situations that women get into and the ways these relationships were. But I think what's been sort of remarkable in both a positive and negative way working on this play is all of the ways that it feels incredibly relevant right now in 2019 in the United States of America. And yeah. I mean, I think there are Noras everywhere. I mean, we talk about, you know, we say that women, you know, oh, in 1879, women couldn't take out a loan without their husband's consent. A woman couldn't get her own credit card until the 1970s in America. That is not that long ago.
Well, so, what did society expect you to do?
Nothing.
Certainly all of the people that would watch the play. Well, did they blame Ibsen for these wild ideas? Do we know what the reaction was?
They did.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, and there was not the premiere production, but a very close after production in Germany, insisted that he rewrite the ending. And that because their concern was literally that people and couples were going to come and see this, and all of the wives were immediately going to leave their husbands. And that was the concern, so they made him rewrite the ending. And he chose to do it kind of against his own will because he said, well, they're going to do it anyway. And I would rather at least have a hand in how they're destroying my play rather than just have it done completely without me.
Oh, I see. Today, I would imagine no one would cave into that kind of pressure. They would leave the ending as is.
Yes.
Well, now we like something to be a little shocking.
Absolutely. And, oh, boy, they would have some articles about them in HuffPost and all around. They would really gain some traction about the censorship of it.
Well, you know, it's funny, you said she's a hero. Something that I think is my favorite thing about Nora is that she's deeply flawed, incredibly complicated. She's not perfect. She's not, you know, she's not always brave, but I think ultimately extraordinarily brave. But that's what, again, to me, makes her so wonderful. It's why I love her. She's a complete person, complicated and messy and very, very real.
But her motivations were right. I mean, she was trying to save him.
Absolutely.
So how can you really blame her or put her down
That's
for that?
That's what I think.
It shows you how the Maurys change over the years for something like that.
It's true. But she spends a lot of time playing a role, as she says. She does a lot of a lot of work making Torvald feel that all the things that he wants to be true about her are true. She's very good at acting like the type of woman that she knows she is supposed to be.
We're speaking with Hilary Clemens, who plays the role of Nora, and Todd Lanker, who plays the role of Torvald, in the Kansas City Actors Theater production of A Doll's House. And we can talk about that, too. There's a reason for that, I guess. It opens up Wednesday the 7th, this Wednesday at 7:30. Runs essentially for 3 weeks after that at the City Stage Theater in Union Station. Go on the web to kcactors.org for a lot more information, and you can make arrangements there. Or you can call the box office number at 816-235-6222 for all that information. There are others besides yourselves in the show. Would you like to talk about some of the other characters and actors? Actors Theater always has a bunch of fine actors.
We are so lucky. We've got an incredible group of people that we're working with. I love this. Let's talk about them.
All right. This is our moment.
Let's talk about everybody.
Yes. Well, the other member of the household, other than our terrific children, is Carla Nowak, who plays our housemaid and has been the housemaid to Nora since her childhood.
And nanny.
And essentially raised Nora. And so Carla is sort of the stabilizing influence as we have Nora sort of willfully flittering about a good bit, and Torvald not concerned with the goings of the house at all. So we sort of define the way that the stage laid it out as Torvald's side of the stage. We've got sort of Nora's living room, and then we've got
the rest of the house
that Carla, who's playing Anne Marie, takes care of.
And we have two children in the cast, Drew and Aria, and they are spectacular, really excellent actors and people. We also have Christina Schaefer, who plays Christine Lind, an old friend of Nora's who comes to visit unexpectedly, and she has things of her own that she wants from the Helmers. And then we have Tyler Rowe as Niels Krogstad, and he is the man who lent Nora money years ago, and also, by coincidence, also happens to work at the same bank that Torvald has just taken over.
Oh, that's dangerous for you.
Your reputation is in question. It certainly is.
Suspense.
Mm-hmm. And then Brian Paulette rounding out the cast, an incredibly talented actor, who is playing a family friend named Dr. Rank, who has a degenerative disease that we won't go into too much, but is a very dear friend to both Torvald and Nora, but has kind of isolated relationships with each of them.
Exactly.
I feel that each of their Torvald and Dr. Rank kind of exist in the office, and we never really see that, but Nora and Dr. Rank exist in the drawing room, and the two ne'er the twain shall meet, really.
That's true.
They each sort of exist in isolation.
How many of these visitors actually become privy to this secret? Anyone?
I can't tell you that.
Oh, you can't? Okay. But some of them
secrets.
Do, then, I guess.
Oh, yes. There's a big element to it that coming out of sort of a sensational sort of melodrama of the time. We have a lot of kind of melodramatic and pot-boiling plot elements, particularly.
Yes.
So everybody has known everybody, and everyone grew up together and has secret histories and
secret motivations.
Oh, yes. The kind of bum, bum, bum.
It's really fun. You know, I think people think about a play like A Doll's House, and they think, oh, it's that play I read in high school, or it's that play I saw in college, or you know, many years ago, and they think of it as sort of a dusty, you know, people in corsets looking sad kind of a play. And it is just not at all. It's very funny, I think. It is very suspenseful, I think. And as Todd said, we've been talking a lot about the melodrama of it. There are a lot of twists and turns and plot thickenings, and it's, I think, a lot more exciting than I think every now and then a person might expect it to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a lot more Dallas than it is, Masterpiece Theater. Uh-huh. It has a lot of thrills to it.
It's true.
I hope this isn't too out of it, as we say. But as I looked the show up online, and there was an online discussion going on as to why Ibsen gave it the title A Doll's House, and there seems to be different interpretations as to why it was called that. Do either one of you want to tackle that?
Well, we can do it together.
We'll do it together.
Well, throughout, Torvald has a lot of little nicknames for Nora. Mm-hmm. He calls her various small animal names.
Squirrel, lark, songbird.
Little things like that, little pet names. And she plays it up as much as mm-hmm. she can because she knows she gets what she wants when she behaves that way with him. And I also have a lot of language about dressing up and playing a role for him. And we talk about, at a certain point, that I'm kept in the house like a doll. I'm a plaything, mm-hmm. as opposed to a person on my own in that home. And
she's been kept by her father,
yes,
that
exactly.
she's been kept by her husband, that she keeps her children as her own dolls, and that there's this sort of cycle of mm-hmm. of almost willful subjugation. I don't mm-hmm. want to put willful on you. And infantilization that goes on.
And that she has also been a willing participant in it to some extent. That
well, she's consider the time
exactly.
and circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably
she was
the best approach. But here she was confronted with this situation. But she was able to take the, I guess today we would say the bull by the horns,
mm-hmm.
yeah. and actually do something about it.
She's very brave.
Yeah. Now, this is the first of two shows that are being done here locally. Actors Theater is kicking it off by doing mm-hmm. A Doll's House. Later on, the Unicorn Theater will step in and do a sequel.
A Doll's House Part 2.
is it actually a sequel?
It is.
Yeah.
Does it follow some of these circumstances on from this point?
Well, what is the year difference? It's 20 years later?
I believe
somewhere around there.
I want to say 15.
15 years later. And it picks up, with all of the same characters, Torvald and Nora and Anne-Marie and their daughter.
One of their children, yeah.
And it picks right back up 15 years later.
Where has she been? Where has he been? Where has everyone been? And how do they feel about each other now?
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different cast, but the same director, and I think all the same.
A number of the same designers
yeah. if not all. Yeah. Yeah. And I think is going to be a real treat for people to be able to see part one part one, the original, yeah,
the
Doll's
original.
House, okay. and part two. I think it's not a lot of places in the country or anywhere have done that.
And when you consider the fact that he was pressured to change the ending, mm-hmm. how does mm-hmm. this affect the second one? I hate to talk too much about that.
Oh, sure.
Because the audience is going to see that.
Yeah.
Well, and we've had to sort of, I think, on our own, like, not think too much about part two. I think we have had to really yeah. focus on telling our story in the most complete way that we possibly can without necessarily letting that show dictate how we do what we're doing mm-hmm. so much, although there are definitely, I think, aspects of our production that point to that one in a really interesting way.
That's why it's been really wonderful to have sort of the unity between the two productions of director and designers, so there's a lot of elements that we don't really have to worry about because that's not really our job, but that the director, looking at this sort of epic story that he's putting together, has added elements, has adjusted some of the set design
mm-hmm. some
type
Easter
of things,
eggs for people
little Easter
see
eggs,
them, yeah.
yeah, and particularly with Carla Noack's character, Anne-Marie, has sort of crafted that character in The Doll's House in order to pay off in Doll's House Part 2. Oh,
I see. So Darren Sextro is, in minor ways, maybe, using your play to also help pave the way, perhaps,
absolutely.
For the second play
absolutely.
Along the way.
Yeah.
He's taken a long view of the story. In the
yes,
sense.
Yes, he definitely has. And is I think has tried to put it all together in a way that each story is told completely and on its own, but also they tie together.
It didn't surprise me when I read the release about the announcement, because Actors Theater has often collaborated mm-hmm. with other groups along mm-hmm. the way, and it goes back to why Actors Theater became Actors Theater.
Yeah.
Actors started the theater themselves.
Yeah.
Absolutely true.
No, and it was a wonderful opportunity that came up, that each theater can do what they do best and what they are known for doing. Actors Theater doing really beautiful actor-driven productions of more traditional work or more well-known work, and The Unicorn doing a brand spanking new play fresh off of a Broadway run. And that the two were able to come together was really terrific kismet.
Well, she has told me before, she only likes to do new things.
Yeah.
And since that is also an older play, it was surprising in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, and Doll's House Part 2 was written just in the last few years, mm-hmm. and did just close on Broadway. So it's even though it has kind of traditional source material, it's almost a season of new plays with traditional source materials at the Unicorn.
True,
we've got Doll's House 2, we've got Bernhardt Hamlet, kind of new takes on old ideas and old plays.
Your biggest challenge now, I would think it would be, now the show is in English, of course, but dealing with the language still, maybe the terminology, things like that might be a challenge.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking a lot about finding the right balance between a heightened and semi-formal way of speaking that feels appropriate to 1879, but that can still feel human and accessible to an audience now. It's a real balance between not sounding too contemporary, but also not sort of putting a wall between you and a contemporary audience member. So that's been something that we've been working on a lot.
And we've really been helped out with this version of the script that we're doing is actually a new adaptation by Darren Sextro of a number of different translations over the years. He did a lot of research and a lot of work kind of compiling and consulting with different texts to come up with what he felt like was a complete contemporary but also traditional adaptation of it that also has some pointers to part two.
You have to give him credit for that. He must be very close to the story.
I think it's a beautiful adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And him doing the adaptation himself has, exactly as you say, it is, I think, resulted in us getting a director who is extraordinarily close with the text and with these characters and who has thought about it a lot,
mm-hmm.
which is great. We can do some really detailed, thoughtful work, all of us together.
Obviously. So what do you have coming up after this? Actors always have things planned.
I have nothing because my husband gets to be in a play next. We have two, I, like Nora, have two small children. So we trade off. We take turns.
Who is your husband?
My husband is actor Matt Schwader. We actually just did a play together this summer. We were in Shakespeare in Love together this summer, which Todd was also in. Todd and I were also uncomfortably married in that play.
Yep.
And
it's our bread and butter, Hillary and I.
It is. And since we worked together for a couple of months, and now we've decided one of us gets to be home with the kids.
Oh, that was rough. You had to deal with the heat and the rain.
Yes.
That was a difficult.
The elements were not on our side this summer.
Todd?
I'm going to be working at the Unicorn in Bernhardt Hamlet, actually coming up just at the end of the year here, which will be wonderful. I'm very excited.
I can't wait to see that.
I've got a lot of history and passion for Shakespeare as a playwright and storyteller, so I'm really excited to work on this new play by the fabulous Teresa Rebeck, of kind of a contemporary take on a really historic event, which was the first female Hamlet.
Do you covet roles like the one you have now? Is that there are meaty roles and there are roles that are not quite as meaty, but still good. But this sounds like it's probably a really meaty one for you.
It is, and I do really enjoy. I keep forgetting my own name. I really enjoy Torvald,
and you play the role of Torvald.
I mean, which one? No, I really enjoy Torvald, and I've loved approaching him and trying to sort of find the human core of what could be sort of a very broad stereotype of the overbearing husband. But yeah, no, I definitely have looked forward to
when you consider
this.
The year and all that, he was probably pretty normal for men in that
Absolutely.
Era.
Absolutely.
Today, I guess he would be considered, an awful guy.
Yeah.
but not by standards.
Generally, people who see run-throughs have that kind of a reaction.
Aww.
Yep, but, you know, that's it's my lot in life. It's not a lot, but it's my life.
That's true. What about you? Any thoughts?
Oh, well, Nora is a dream role for me. She's one of those, you know, if you're an actor, you want to play Nora. You know, there's a little list of the roles you want to play, and that's usually on people's lists. She's a big, big challenge. The play is about 100 pages long, our script, and I'm on all but five of them, so it's also just sort of a mountain to climb. It's a big challenge. It's a lot to to memorize just on a purely technical level. I have to dance a tarantella at one point, like you do. It's a role that comes with a lot of baggage. People have a lot of opinions about Nora and the choices that she makes, and so. So did I before I started working on the play, and continue to have a lot of opinions about her. It's a pretty big thrill for me to get to work on this role.
Show opens this Wednesday, the 7th of August at 7:30 p.m., essentially for 3 weeks, like, for instance, the first week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The next week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday as well. A Monday performance on the 19th, then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, two on Saturday, closes on the 25th with a matinee at 2 o'clock p.m. at the City Stage Theater at Union Station. The number to call for more information, 816-235-6222, or, of course, online at kcactors.org. I want to thank my guests for coming by.
Thanks so much for having
us. And explaining all of this to me. Yes, it would be scandalous in that era. Hillary Clemens, who plays the role of Nora Helmer, and Todd Lanker, who plays the role of Torvald Helmer, in the Kansas City Actors Theater production of A Doll's House, opening this Wednesday, August the 7th. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a brief break. Then when we return, we have much more to tell you about it. We're going to go downtown for this next interview when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. The 2001 movie The Fast and the Furious was based on a true story about L.A. street racers. Over the years, the films in the franchise have morphed into action fantasies so preposterous that they make James Bond flicks look like documentaries by comparison. Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham star in the 9th film in the franchise, Fast and the Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. They play rival rogue lawmen who try to save the world from a cyborg-human hybrid played by Idris Elba. It's utterly absurd, but the Johnson-Statham team-up is amusing. The way to enjoy this movie is to forget the laws of physics, throw logic out the window, and just go with the action flow. The Farewell is a sweet-natured and sentimental comedy about an Asian-American woman, played by Awkwafina, who travels to China when she learns her beloved grandmother is terminally ill. Problem is, the family has decided to hide the truth from the elderly lady and to stage a sham marriage to make her feel better. Alternately funny and poignant, The Farewell is a wistful crowd-pleaser. Comic Mark Maron leads the cast in Sword of Trust, a wacky comedy about two women who try to pawn off an antique sword as evidence that the South actually won the Civil War. The efforts to sell the item get them into hot water with the Old South underworld. The actors improvise their dialogue, and the results are sometimes hilarious. The late singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen and his one-time lover and muse, Marianne Island, are the subject of the touching documentary Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love. The film is a melancholy overview of their troubled relationships, and it's a cautionary tale about the toll of open marriages. Also opening this week, The Operative is a spy thriller about an Israeli Mossad agent's mysterious disappearance. Diane Kruger and Martin Freeman star. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM.
Freeze Frame!
Thanks for tuning in to KKFI. The future is here. Simply tell your smart speaker, play KKFI. If you haven't already, give it a shot. KKFI can be wherever you are.
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. We're going to journey on over to downtown right now. As you probably know, the Kansas City Museum over at Corinthian Hall is undergoing renovations. And in its stead, they have satellite locations where they've moved some of the things and have new things as well. And we want to hear what's all going on because some of it is very, very interesting indeed. Denise Morrison is with us. She is the Director of Collections and Curatorial Services for the Kansas City Museum. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
I remember back when I was in college, the university was run by the Board of Curators, and people would make jokes. Oh, are we all museum pieces here? So maybe it might be useful for you to explain exactly what a curator does.
Well, curator can be used in a lot of different professions, and is. And for the museum profession, it's an individual who has studied and knows a particular collection, a curator of a specific curator of Native American art, or curator of particular type of paintings. Then there's just general curators who know a lot about everything, who know how to take care of objects or how to take care of archival materials. They know them so well that they write about them and can curate, can get that, you know, curation of a specific lot of items or a general field.
And things probably that fit together.
Exactly. Yeah. That I'm not Webster, unfortunately, but yeah, that's generally the gist.
Well, while the renovation is going on, you have two facilities going on right now, both of them in pretty much the same area of downtown. One is at 800 Broadway, and the other is at 801 Broadway, right across the street. So that makes it very convenient. So you have two areas of displaying down there.
We do.
Let's talk about them. Whichever one you'd like to go with first. One is right across the street from the other.
They are. At 8th and Broadway, we very happily took over the Historic Garment District Museum, which had been at 801 Broadway since 2002. That had been founded by Ann Brownfield and Harvey Freed, who were both Garment District. They lived and breathed it for their careers. Ann was a designer, and Harvey was salesman slash marketer slash eventually co-owner of a garment company in Kansas City. So they saw the garment district dying. They saw people forgetting about it, and they wanted to offer something for the community to remember. And so they started collecting. Anne had been a designer, and she collected a lot of material that had been made in Kansas City. And they opened a little place at 8th and Broadway. They were given a space. It's really a glorified hallway in the Poindexter Building, which symbolically was a building that housed many different garment companies over the years. And they opened a little museum in 2002. But they were ready by 2015 to pass it on. And so we took that over. We had our own fashion collection, so it seemed a natural adjunct to what we already had and were doing. And so in the fall of 2015, we took that over and kept it open. And as our main museum was getting closer, we'd been keeping it open on sort of a halftime basis. Mm-hmm. We would give tours of the empty building, but we really were getting ready to close it, you know, for the renovation. We wanted to keep a presence, and we realized it would be beneficial to be down in the Garment District close by the museum we were already running and keeping going. We just were lucky to find a first floor in the building across, which used to be the old, what people called the Carnival Building. And so we have our, what we call our satellite facility at 800 Broadway. We've got about 3,000 square feet, so we're able to do programming. We do small exhibits, and we've kept them fashion related so that it goes with the Garment District. And then we can take people across to the Garment District. So it works out really well for both facilities. And once we move back to Corinthian Hall, we'll still keep the Garment District Museum going. We have a decision to make in which facility we want to keep it, and if we can afford to stay in the 800 space, which we're leasing. But we're looking at those opportunities. But we'll keep a presence in the Garment District, because that's what and Harvey wanted, and we want to keep that going.
At one time, Kansas City had a thriving garment industry.
Very thriving. Downtown. And there was a book that came out, five, six, maybe 7 years ago, on garment districts around the country, New York and Chicago and the bigger cities. Kansas City wasn't listed at all. It didn't get a chapter, might have gotten a mention on one page. And when asked why, the author said, well, we couldn't find any information about the Garment District in Kansas City. And that kind of hits home. It's Broadway is now dominated by those buildings, but they're all business buildings now or lofts. And although it is a historic district, people don't put that together with what it was, but it was the largest employer of women in the city at one time. It had the second largest garment union in the country behind New York, the ILGWU. So it had a huge presence, and to keep that going, even in a small, modest way, I think Ann and Harvey did a great thing. And the collection's lovely. Everything in it relates to Kansas City. And we had a few items in our large fashion collection that related to Kansas City companies, but not like this. This, everything in it has come from a Kansas City company, and it's really marvelous. So it's been a lot of fun exploring that and getting to know more about it. We have people come in all the time that say parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles worked, you know, for so-and-so or worked in that building. And it's really a great experience to talk to those people and to see a part of Kansas City history just stay alive.
Sure. Now, if we were to go back in our time tunnel to those days, what kinds of things, when we walked into those buildings, would we see going on? A lot of activity with people manufacturing. Was it mostly designing?
It was designing and manufacturing. They made everything there. And it's why I know a lot of people have probably heard the term Petticoat Lane and have not really understood what that means because it is long gone. But Petticoat Lane was that strip of street in between Grand and Main, I believe. And it's still there. It's kind of, you know, it ends and you have to turn right or, well, yeah, you can turn left, right or left. At the end there, at one time, was a big Macy's, and it was all the retail section, and they were close by the garment district, and that's how it became known as Petticoat Lane, because they were close by. But garment district was very literally designers, manufacturers, salesmen, you name it. But Kansas City was known a lot for menswear. It was well known for custom garments for men as well as women and children. And they didn't, although there were hat makers in town, there weren't any big milliner manufacturers. It really wasn't a lot of accessories. It was the basic garments.
I was going to ask, what kinds of things, if anything, did they specialize in? But you've mentioned hats,
yeah,
and petticoats, obviously, because there's a street and a park nearby.
Yeah. And actually, I don't know its official name right now off the top of my head, but right there outside at 800 Broadway is a very small little park. And at one end of it is what we call the needle sculpture, which is what really began the garment district. Ann and Harvey helped get that created. So it's a needle being thread through a button, a big red button, and it stands very tall in that little space. And that was a big thing they wanted to do to commemorate the garment district. And then at that point they thought, well, why can't we do more? But yeah, that little park there, which is lovely, is all about the garment, kind of commemorating that.
Which side of the street?
If we're going south, the Garment District Museum's on the left.
On the left.
Yes. No. And 800 Broadway, where we have ours, on the right.
Okay, well, let's talk about the garments first. What kinds of things do you have on display? Of what era and what types of... I'm cheating, folks. I did see on the website a display 100 years of swim fashion.
That actually is part of our Kansas City Museum collection.
Oh, okay.
We do have a couple pieces from the Garment District, but Garment District wasn't really known for swimwear, but the swimwear exhibit is part of our 800, kind of our satellite museum. We're trying to keep all those exhibits related to fashion, since we're down in sort of the fashion area. And we do two exhibits a year focusing on some part of our collection or some thing. So in the past, we've done an exhibit on menswear. We did a small quilt exhibit. But this thing for the summer, we've done on swimwear. We have in the collection quite a few garments from our earliest young woman on display is from 1904, and she's dressed from head to toe.
I'll bet.
Even with slippers and a hose, so that nothing would be shown. All the way up through the 90s, early 2000s. And we have a few children's garments. We have men's wear. In the 20s, we have five 20s swim bathing suits. They really weren't swimsuits until a little later. Janssens kind of coined that phrase, swimsuit, before they were kind of bathing garments. But the swimwear in the 20s, men's and women's were hard to discern the difference. They were all about the same. Men's had kind of bigger arm openings, a little more tanky and not as fitted. But we like to ask our visitors if they can tell the difference between the men's and the women's. And some get it right, and some are perplexed because they all look the same. Navy blue or black wool is what's going on in the 20s. And so you see a nice progression. We have a three-piece suit from the early 60s, and we have swimwear from the 90s, and we have just some fun stuff. We have some fun sunglasses. We have what were known as beach pajamas. In the 30s, they were loungewear that was became quite popular to wear on the beach, and so that's why they became, including one that has a Nelly Don label. Yeah. So something locally made. We've got a swimsuit from the 90s that was made by a Kansas City company. So we've got a couple garment district pieces that are in there as well. It's a fun exhibit.
We were talking about, or I asked you about Nelly Don earlier, and you told me some interesting things. I mean, she's really not on display at the museum, you said, because at the time, I guess she had become too big to still be associated with the scene in Kansas City.
Well, Nelly was not physically part of the garment district, but she was creating garments and building her company in Kansas City at the same time the garment district was growing. So they parallel, and she was certainly the largest manufacturer of women's wear in Kansas City throughout the time that the garment district was thriving. So we do have garments from Nelly Don in the collection, and even people that come and are fascinated with the garment district or interested from out of town know that name. They know nothing else about Kansas City Garment District, but somehow they know Nellie's name. So it would be remiss of us not to talk about Nelly, and we do have some Nelly Don on display. We try to change the Garment District Museum pieces seasonally. So in spring, summer, we've got more light stuff, and in winter, we've got coats and jackets and heavier stuff. So we try to include Nelly and all that. And although you can say 100 years of fashion for the Garment District, the majority of what was collected really is around World War II and after. It's a little rarer to find garment district clothing earlier than that, although they do exist. We do have a Nelly Don dress from the 20s, and we have these beach pajamas now from the 30s, but we really don't have a lot from the garment district before the World War II and post time, and that was kind of okay because that was the height. The post-war and World War II were really the height of the garment district. They started slowly slowing down in the 60s. And by the late 60s, when the retail stores started leaving downtown, you started seeing the garment district slow down as well. Companies leaving. More garments were being manufactured out of town and out of the country. And several of the larger ones struggled through the 70s. And by the early 80s, most were gone. There were a couple that were still around. But by the early 80s, pretty much all of them were gone.
When you look at pictures from that era, looking at the men now, they're all wearing hats. So I guess hats were of fashion then. I'm from Independence, so I see a lot of pictures of Harry Truman and his cronies, and I can say cronies because I know the sons of some of those cronies. They say that they wore hats all the time. That was the fashion thing.
Really, accessories were important to earlier generations, and it wasn't just hats. You wouldn't have left home. Women wouldn't have left home without gloves and a hat. They, you know, would have been coordinated shoes, dress, hats, gloves. I mean, it would have all. And I remember even as a child of the 60s, early 60s, at Easter, it was very important to my mother, not so much to me, but to my mother, that I had a fully coordinated Easter outfit from hat, you know, from head to toe. And that kind of began dying out in my childhood. And you don't see that quite as much, but accessories were, that was just part of your getting dressed. You just did not leave the house without a hat. You didn't leave the house without gloves a lot of times.
Sure.
So,
and now we're lucky if they don't wear jeans everywhere.
Yeah. But, yeah. Or pajamas themselves, but, or something like that.
But of course, things change. I don't mean to be critical. So you have this display, and this is on the then east side of Broadway, the one.
801 Broadway is on the east side is 801 Broadway.
Okay.
One side.
Well, our address is 3901 Main, and we're on the east side of the street. So, yes, you would be right.
Gosh.
It would be 801. So
801 is the Historic Garment District Museum, and that's the historic Poindexter building. It's on the first level. And you can only get in that museum by coming across the street to 800 Broadway and beginning your visit with us in our satellite facility. We check you in. You can decide whether to see the exhibit there. Or you can just choose to go see the Garment District Museum. And at that point, we would, you know, take you over and you can see. And it's just a quick walk across the street. A busy, busy Broadway, but to walk across the street and see the Garment District Museum. So you can do both. You can do one or the other, whichever you'd like. And we do have some fun programs. The swimwear exhibit is not just, it's a fun exhibit, but there's some issues that we bring up. For instance, segregation in the pools. Each of the set of clothing that we have on display, we talk about a favorite swimming hole from that time period. So, you know, Wynwood Lake, the Wynwood Lake Beach, and the Electric Park and the Crystal Pool at Fairyland Park. And we talk about Swope Park. And Swope Park, of course, was the reason for a major civil rights case in the 1950s. In fact, it was right before the Brown versus Board of Education. It was all around that time period. And we delve into that history, and in August we're going to be having someone, Jerry Sanders, is going to be coming over and giving a talk about that important case. So we do programming there at 800 Broadway as well. We do lectures, and we've done some receptions and fun stuff there. So it's just a nice little space.
So those exhibits will still be going on, and if I understood you earlier, once Corinthian Hall opens back up, you may or may not still have some of those things still available.
We will definitely keep the Garment District available. The question is, will we stay in the little
sure.
space?
Oh, sure.
Will we expand into the larger space if we can afford to? But those are decisions we've got to make down the line. But we will definitely always have a presence there. We want to keep that. Definitely. We want to keep that thing that Ann and Harvey began going. That was it's an important part of Kansas City history, and we want to keep that going.
Sure. Well, clothes are important. When you have a picture and you're trying to identify the year, well, the first things they look at is how the people are dressed.
Fashion is really a great topic and a great source of you always look at fashion, you look at cars, you look at when you're trying to date stuff. But, yeah, fashion is important, and it being so important to, you know, Kansas City's livelihood and economy for so many years, it just behoove us to keep that memory alive.
It's closed now for renovation at Corinthian Hall. Mm-hmm. And from what I've read, about a year away from opening up again.
Mm-hmm.
See, I remember back in grade school days, every year we went, sometimes more than one time during the year, to see all that was over there. I have a memory of the big bear downstairs. That's probably long gone, by the way.
So yes, you're dating yourself. But I like to say that the new museum is for a new generation. Every decade, the Kansas City Museum seemed to make itself over and make itself contemporary for the generation it was serving. And so we're anxious for everyone to see this, what we're calling the new Kansas City Museum. The building, J.E. Dunn's completed the construction phase. So we now have this glorious-looking empty building that we now have to fill. And so that's what we're working on now. We're in that phase where we're working with a fabulous design company, Gallagher & Associates, who are helping us through that design and development phase for all the exhibits. And it's real exciting and somewhat stressful.
I'll bet.
We'll, 'cause we want to get it right. And there'll be new things for people to see. And I know a lot of people will be coming to see their favorite things. And they might not see it. They might. But it'll all be new and exciting, and we're anxious for Kansas City to see it.
The two locations, and they're right across the street from each other, 800 Broadway or 801 Broadway, right across the street. The number to call for more information on that is 816-513-0720. Or, of course, you can hop on that World Wide Web and get information as well, kansascitymuseum.org, and ask them when they're open. I guess the hours are 10 to 4. At least that's what I jotted down.
We are 10 to 4 Wednesday through Saturday, and that's for both locations.
Like I said, I remember from my grade school days going over there quite a bit, how magnificent that building was. It'll be nice to see it once again going on. Denise Morrison, the Director of Collections and Curatorial Services for the Kansas City Museum. You can see many things down there right now. 100 years of swim fashion might be particularly interested. That's one of the things being featured at the satellite facility of the Kansas City Museum. Again, 800 or 801 Broadway, and you go to the west side of the street first.
Yes.
To begin your tour.
You go to 800 Broadway first and check in, and that's where the swimwear exhibit is. Then whether you choose to see that or not, and I hope you do, so you're welcome there as well.
Thank you very much, Denise. KansasCityMuseum.org, 816-513-0720. Thanks so much for updating us and keeping us up on
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Loved being here.
Oh, glad to have you with us again. The Jazz Insider is coming up next. We'll have jazz this afternoon on KKFI. Jazz from 1 to 3, then the blues from 3 to 6. That's the KKFI tradition right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.
To the Arts Magazine Show right here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Jazz Afternoon, jazz music from 1 to 3 p.m., then the blues from 3 to 6 right here at KKFI. Currently 86 degrees in Kansas City this afternoon, partly sunny with a high of 90. And tonight, 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 1 a.m. with a low around 73 degrees. More rain possible, and warmer on Tuesday with a high of 96. I'm Sam Wiseman. I'll be your host for the next couple hours. Lots of great jazz music coming your way. Hope you can stay with us right here at your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI.